metal forms burn toxic green. Vacant eyes lit with everlasting hellfire.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Let's Watch Scary Movies. As always, we are your horror hosts. I am Jenny.
And I am Caitlin. Hello, hello.
Hi, and if you're listening to this, then you have survived the UK apocalypse. The insane... We are recording this on, I forgot, the 20th of July. So the last 2 days have been hell on earth if you've been in the UK.
It's, yes, the end is nigh, I think.
Yeah.
The four horsemen of the apocalypse are coming. It's crazy for the last 2 days. It's funny because in the last episode we kind of talked about, oh, it's, you know, it's June and it's cold. Now it's like absolutely blistering outside. So basically for those on the Fahrenheit realm, such as myself, it was 101 degrees yesterday. And if you are living in America, you might not be aware, but something like less than 5% of buildings in Europe, not just England, but all of Europe, have air conditioning. Less than 5%. So the vast majority of residential homes do not. So I was just sort of lying on the floor making sweat angels.
Yep. And it's like our houses are designed to retain heat because it's always fucking cold here. Right. So like today, it's an Arctic 25 degrees, I think, but my house is still well into the 30s because it's just, even with all the windows open, because it's just retaining the heat. You touch the walls and things and the walls are hot.
It's crazy because like the weather doesn't bother me so much. Like when I went out in it yesterday, which I did briefly, it's fine. I mean, I'm from Florida, it's not a big deal, but when you're, like you said, when you're in the house, and gosh, I felt bad for my neighbors who live upstairs, because apparently they were saying it was just sweltering. It was even hotter upstairs. Obviously, heat rises, and so they were dying. And there was just no breeze on the first day at all. But
no.
But yes, today is much better. It rained yesterday, and as opposed to rain in Florida, which just makes it hotter and more humid, it actually lowered the temperature a bit, so it's a little bit more manageable.
So I'm guessing you watched this last night, didn't you, the film?
I did.
So obviously we're starting our sweltering summer camp slasher series. This is the first episode, and we're starting with the first, I guess, in some ways.
Like the daddy of all the 80s slasher horror movies. Friday the 13th. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I was watching this and I'm like thinking, this is like Halloween, Black Christmas's like trashy younger sister.
Yeah, this is like if this was National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, like Friday the 13th would be Cousin Eddie.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. I kept thinking,
Merry Christmas, the shit is full.
Because I kept thinking how like they've blatantly stolen so many different.
I have a lot of facts and okay. Things about
I'm here for the facts. I'm here for the kids. Basically, first of all, can we just welcome you all to the 80s summer slasher series? Because it is time. It is hot outside. It is time to get your sleeping bags, your tents.
Yeah,
it's time to get a little horny and like.
Yep.
Bang random camp counselors. I don't know, but now's the time. It's we're deep into summer, and for the UK European summer, it's hot as balls, so I'm excited for it.
Yeah,
this is a sort of a list of movies to me that are just really fun, entertaining. We'll talk about whether or not they're scary, but you know,
yeah.
I'm here for it. It's a vibe, as the kids say.
So you must have watched this last night.
I did.
So not only were you, you know, dying, because yesterday, like Hinton said, in UK terms, it hit over 40 degrees in the UK yesterday. And last night was hell on earth it didn't rain. It rained nearby, but I didn't get any rain. My friends, like four streets over, did, but I didn't. So yeah, I don't know how much it rained.
It didn't rain much at all, and it wasn't until about, I don't know, 8 o'clock or something like that.
So I was already... gonna say, so you must have been like dying of.
I was watching
this film.
I did like a setup, so I had all the windows wide open. I brought the fan from my bedroom out and placed it directly on my face. So, you know, it was okay, and it was giving me those Camp Crystal Lake summertime feelings. So it was fun. It was like I was fully immersed in this virtual reality of Camp Crystal Lake.
Well, shall we just get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it because there's a lot
to talk about.
There is.
Let's go.
Now it's time for a breakdown.
So, 1980.
Well, yeah. 1980. So, 1980, good year. None of us were born yet. The feeling I got from this is that it very much, I'm thinking, was filmed in like the late 70s because everything from the fashion to the hair, I wasn't really getting 80s yet so much.
Yeah, like it came out in 1980. So yeah, it would have been filmed towards the end of the 70s and directed by Sean S. Cunningham.
Sean S. Cunningham. Tell me about him, Jenny, because...
So, right. Basically, this film came about because obviously Halloween was such a hit, and he was like, okay, I want to make a film. And he only had a title, Friday the 13th, and he put an ad out in a paper, I can't remember which paper it was, basically being like, Friday the 13th will be, you know, the scariest film you've ever seen. And he didn't have a plot, he had nothing. Only reason he put the advert out was to see if anyone would try and sue him for using the concept of Friday the 13th, if anybody else had it in development. And he couldn't find out, so that was how he did it.
Love that. Okay.
Very low budget, less than 700,000, so well under $1 million. This film made $120 million, so very, very profitable. Crashed with the critics.
It was quite like a conflicting response. Like some liked it, some said it was too violent.
Yes, basically they took the ideas from Halloween, and you know, John Carpenter even admits he got his ideas from Black Christmas. They took the idea of Halloween and they were like, right, let's remove some of the plot and let's amp up the gore. Because Halloween, the original Halloween is not a gory film, not really. But Friday the 13th definitely steps that up, which in my eyes is the best thing about this film. The best thing about this film is the fact that it had the Wizard of Gore himself, Tom Savini, on special effects. We all know I'm a big Tom Savini fan. I'm going to meet him in October at the Love of Horror convention.
Did you watch this with Andy? Did he have a Tom Savini boner the whole time?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, well, we've watched so many like documentaries with Tom Savini or about Tom Savini. There's a great one on Shudder, all about his entire career. It's really worth watching. And you know, I've listened to podcasts with him and things talking about his career, and yeah, just what he does in this film is possibly the only good thing in it. And even he said there are things that everybody loves about this film that weren't in the script, and he was just like, "Can we do this?"
Well, thank God for him then, because there's a lot that's, you know, it has kind of a cult status, and I think I can understand that, but watching it and being in the moments of watching it, when we like go through the, like I'll say, but I mean, I do think a lot of the dialogue was really, really wanting. I just kept thinking like, no one talks like this.
Nope.
Nobody. No, although the cop, I did love the cop. He had some of the best lines in the whole film.
Yeah, he wasn't really taking any shit, was he, that cop?
It is sort of funny how you just said about, sorry, I just remembered this, that you just said about it being called Friday the 13th, because really the plot in and of itself has pretty much nothing to do with Friday the 13th. It could be on Friday the 22nd, it could be on Tuesday the 11th.
It's Jason's birthday.
Well, sure, but I mean idea of Friday the 13th as
being unlucky,
all of that existed obviously way before the movie, and so, but he doesn't go into any of that. It's just I feel like he just decided arbitrarily, like, I'm going to make a horror movie. And it's brilliant in a lot of ways because there is no other Friday the 13th movie. And I know the last time I watched this actually was on a Friday the 13th, maybe in 2018, 2017. I remember, oh, it's Friday the 13th this year. I'm going to make sure I watch
the movie. How many? Because there are...
I think there's five total.
Oh, no, Caitlin, there's way more than that.
What are you counting the crossover though?
Even I wasn't including counting... Freddy versus Jason, there's more than that.
Well, no, because I wasn't counting the Elm Street crossover.
Yeah, the Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah, there's loads of those. I thought there were five parts like in and of itself, but no.
Oh no. I think there's about 10.
Oh, you're right, actually. There might even be
Jason X.
Yeah, Jason X. Isn't that the one in space?
I'm getting up a list of the films because we need this.
It's true.
Movies.
The real question is here, Jenny, how many of them are we going to cover on the podcast?
All of them? How many have you seen?
I think I've seen the second part, and I think that's... Oh, and I've seen... I think I've seen whatever the one Jason goes to hell. I've seen that.
Right, okay. You ready for this?
And I've seen a lot of the Freddy versus Jason. I think, in fact, I saw Freddy versus Jason in the movie theater.
Me too.
Yeah.
Right, so you've got Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th part 2, Friday the 13th part 3, which was the 3D one. Okay. Then you've got Friday the 13th, the final chapter, which is number 4. Then Friday the 13th, a new beginning. Friday the 13th parts 4. No, that makes no sense. So 6, Jason Lives. Friday the 13th part 7, The New Blood. Friday the 13th, part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. We're still in the 80s during all of these. So that's like eight films in the 80s.
Yeah.
Then it's Jason Goes to Hell, the final Friday.
Yeah.
Jason X.
Yeah.
Freddy versus Jason. And Friday the 13th, which I think was the remake in 2009.
Okay, I have not seen the remake, have you?
I don't think so. If I have, I don't remember it. And I have a, like, I thought they were going to make another one. I thought I heard something that was, like, they were going to take up to, like, 13 films.
But... And nowhere along the line did anyone think to make Friday the 14th, Friday the 15th?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
Maybe it's
And the thing better. Is, going back to, sorry, I'm going to probably talk about Tom Savini a lot in this episode, but go back to Tom Savini, and he was saying about how when he made Friday the 13th, it was off the back of Dawn of the Dead. Because he has his big special effects film that he did before this one. And he basically came straight off the back of one onto this. And this was supposed to be a one-off film. None of the rest, I don't think, were directed by Sean S. Cunningham. Tom Savini was given the script for Friday the 13th part 2 and was like, no, this makes no sense. Jason's supposed to be dead. You know, I don't understand it. So he refused to do it. And instead he went and did The Burning, which is one that I've recommended that we do.
Yes, The Burning is going to be a part of our summer slasher
series. And I actually didn't realize that Tom Savini had done The Burning, so I'm quite interested in that. But yeah, and then he came back for the fourth one because they said it's called Friday the 13th. Very difficult for someone with a speech impediment to say. Friday the 13th, the final chapter. And it was supposed to be the last one, and that's why he came back for that. And then literally the next year, they made...
But it never is the final.
It's never the end.
Jason lives.
Well, does he?
The whole idea of Jason is sort of that, like, urban legend idea, I think. And then they just took it kind of next level, like, as the series progressed, you know?
Yeah, because in the second one, I watched... Because me and Andy started watching these... during one of the lockdowns. Might actually have been last year. We watched the first three, I think. And the second one changes the story ever so slightly. As in, people say that they never found, you know, the little boy's body and he'd just been living in the woods all this time.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why. And then a few films in, he dies, you know, for good. And then there's one, have you seen the one where, like, someone puts something, like a metal stick, like, near his grave? Or like puts the machete in his grave and lightens it and strikes it and reanimates him. And that's how he comes back as like the zombie Jason is then in all the other films.
Right. Because I was thinking, like, it starts off like this kind of legend, and then he eventually is embodied and has a full, you know, corporeal form that is very Michael Myers-esque in the way that he walks and is singularly focused and, you know, happens to be everywhere all at once, like omnipresent. But that is not obviously in this movie. And in fact, you know, per Scream, he actually doesn't kill anybody. It's his mom. So, but yeah, they do change that story. Because I vaguely remember part two as well. But anyway, we should, you know. So it is 1980, but actually in the film, it's 1958. And we open at night at the lake house. You can see like the lake, and there's like a little canoe, and it's Camp Crystal Lake, 1958. And there's
you hear like crickets chirping.
It's very atmospheric. You hear people kind of singing, and the camera sort of pans in, and you've got these campers sitting around. Someone's got an acoustic guitar. They're having like their kumbaya moment.
It sounds like Jesus Camp.
It is a little bit Jesus Campy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then you get this point of view. And I feel like if you wanted to make this film into a drinking game, it would be drink every time they do the killer POV. So, and not PIV, by the way, POV. So anyway, the killer point of view, you get that first shot of this person, you don't know who, opening the door to the dorms, what looks like to be the dorm rooms. And you get this, it's like sound.
Do you know what it is? So it's the killer, and it's a recording of the killer saying, kill, 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 mum, mum, mum. And they put through effects. And then throughout everyone, even me, I'm like, but it's like,
because I got the kill. You do get the kill part later. You can make that out a little, like the, maybe they worked on their diction. I don't know, but it sounds like they need better vocal warm-ups, clearly.
Me, 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 me.
But I'd forgotten about the breathing noises. And as soon as that happened, I'm like, oh, here we go. Anyway, then it's sort of, the camera pans back to this like sing-along, and this guy and girl counselor are kind of like making
eyes.
Yeah, they're totally eye-fucking.
Eye-fucking. That's what's happening at Jesus Camp.
And then they sneak away to like a loft, basically, to make sexy times.
And I love how the girl's like, oh, you know, I thought you said it would be special. And he has like a tarp or a thing. He's like, it is special. And lays it here. I'm laying out this beautiful romantic tarp on a dirty wooden floor.
In a dirty loft.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
That's how I like it. Very special. So then you have this kind of point of view person coming up the stairs, and you know, then there's a little bit of a like struggle. The point of view person kind of cuts the guy across the stomach, and the girl's struggling and she's kind of screaming, and then the camera freezes on her face like and then you have the title credits.
I've even got written at this point already, oh, Tom Savini. The big heart, because they recognize whoever it is, they recognize them, because they're like, oh, we weren't doing anything, we were just, you know, we were just fooling around. Like, they think they're in trouble, they're not scared as in, oh my god, there's a killer, like there's a psycho. They're like, oh shit, we've been caught fooling around, and then stab.
And in fact, you're right, because she doesn't even start really like screaming or freaking out in terror until her boyfriend is killed. But yeah, so then you've got these title credits with, I don't know about you, but there's very questionable orchestral music. I've read in some of the reviews that that the movie was praised by some people for the sound. I was not a fan. I found it, I don't know, not particularly effective, just really kind of jarring. It was almost like they wanted to go for that psycho, like, kind of like sound effect, but didn't really, but then they added in the breathing. I don't know.
It's a lot. John Carpenter's synth, this is not.
Right, exactly. Like, it was not effective in the same way at all. So, but anyway, then you've got, so after the title credits, you come, there's another one which says Friday the 13th of June, present day, aka 1980. And they're in New Jersey. And you get this, you're introduced to this, like, super chipper cute brunette with just fabulous hair, very like yep. feathered, curly hair. Again, like a little more 70s and 80s I was getting, but okay. She's called Annie. She stops into a cafe to ask for some directions.
I love the fact that even like, she's walking through this town and there's nobody around and there's a dog. And she's like, oh, hi.
Yeah.
How did I get to Camp Crystal Lake?
Do you speak English?
Yeah. Like, hi.
She does have like a full convo, one-sided convo with the dog.
With the dog, which was something I would absolutely do.
I mean, I think it goes some way into making her likable, I suppose. And, you know.
Oh, maybe... she's my favorite.
Me too. Too bad about Annie. But yeah, so she
yep.
so she pops into this cafe and she's like, hey everybody, I'm looking for Camp Crystal Lake. And everyone in the cafe kind of like stops. They're like, what was that? And so this random guy is like, oh, it's 20 miles. I'm going this way. I can take you part of the way.
Yeah.
He's mildly creepy, you know?
He's a little bit handsy, I think.
And... he's like 80s creepy. He's like, yeah, well, girls look as good as you. And then yeah. you're like twice your age.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And there's the fact that like everyone's like, I can't believe they're opening up the camp again. And they mentioned Steve, somebody who's the guy who's been up there, like fixing up the camp to reopen it.
Oh, yeah, Steve.
Yeah. And they're like, he'll go crazy up there too. As she's like, going to this guy's truck, we meet, what's his name, the crazy guy? Randy?
Crazy Ralph.
Ralph, that's it. Crazy Ralph.
Well, the days before it were like mental illness was considered with any sort of dignity or reverence. Yep. Yeah. No, just yep. Crazy Ralph.
Crazy Ralph. He's walking around. Shouting about his death curse.
And he calls it Camp Blood, and it has a death curse, which sounds like, I don't know, he's got his period or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I frequently have a death curse.
Like blood. Every month.
Every month.
I got your Camp Blood right here.
Death curse, got it.
But these names just make me laugh, like Camp Blood. I don't know. So I guess it's supposed to, like, I don't know, as an audience member, it's supposed to give me some sort of sense of foreboding. I don't know. Then they're, as they're in they get in the truck and the truck driver's taking her and he's basically like telling her to quit. And he's saying like, Camp Crystal Lake is jinxed.
Yeah. And... but what makes me laugh is that when she gets in the truck after her run-in with Crazy Ralph and she's like, oh, what's his problem? And he's like, oh, he's crazy. Don't listen to anything he has to say. But about Camp Blood.
But let me just repeat everything.
Yeah, let me just repeat everything that Crazy Ralph said. But I'm not, no one's got put crazy in front of my name. Therefore, you should believe me. And he's like, did your boss tell you what happened? And she's like, no, what happened? And he won't tell her. He's just like, quit now.
It's silly. And this is one of many instances where I will point out to you the, I don't know, absurdity of the dialogue. Like it really, especially the women. I'm very frequently thinking to myself during this film, who wrote this? It's got to be a man. And the actresses are selling it. They're doing their best, but it's very just strange.
It's definitely not Deborah Hill. This is not a Deborah Hill production.
It is not. So Annie doesn't care, basically. She doesn't care. She's got to go work in the kitchen. So anyway. So then you kind of shift over to... now we're in a truck with Kevin Bacon.
And some hillbilly music.
Do you know?
There's a lot of dueling banjos happening.
It was very, like, Dukes of Hazzard. The Dukes of Hazzard theme song. Do you know what? We're going to pop it into the episode. It sounds like this. So you've got Kevin Bacon, who's also, I don't know about you, but some of their names I just could not get.
Literally the only person's name I remember is Annie.
Right? Because she says, well, I'm Annie. And so you've got Kevin Bacon, who I just called Kevin Bacon the whole time.
Yep.
Marcy and some dude. So you're kind of introduced to them. And
it's Ned, I think.
I thought it was Phil. I think that's Phil.
Is Ned? Because
there is one called Phil. There's one called Neddy.
Yeah, I think Neddy's the dickhead one who like keeps pulling all the pranks. Funny one. Yeah, the funny one. And I thought it was him that was in the truck with Marcy.
I think
and
it's Phil, but
Kevin
you know
Bacon.
What?
Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, you're right.
He's
might
a white
be
douchebag.
Exactly. Oh yeah, yeah. Don't get me started on the lack of diversity here because everyone's white, everyone's straight. It's 1980, so anyway. But yeah, so then you are introduced to Alice of the Princess Diana hair. That's what
yes.
I was getting, full 80s bowl cut Princess Di. So yep. She's really the only one with an 80s haircut. I also had that haircut when I was a child. So it was familiar in a comforting way. But so then you go out. Alice just seems sort of like Steve's little bitch. So I don't know. But he's kind of bossing her around. And
yeah, we meet Steve, and he's the owner of the camp. And he's in the most amazing outfit. He's shirtless with like a neckerchief and like little tight short shorts.
And socks kind of like pulled up. But shirtless, and then glasses. Oh yeah, that was,
I think he also had like a Princess Diana bowl cut.
This was kind of like long and feathered. It was not quite the bowl cut that Alice is rocking, but I mean, he's also completely a vibe. So you get that there's a little bit of like a background between the two of them. He's kind of asking her to stay one more week. I wasn't sure, like, did they used to be together?
I'm not sure. Like,
it was weird.
Is she, like, one of the like camp counselors? And she said she doesn't like it there. And he's like, oh, let's give it one more week. And then he, like, touches her in a creepy way. And he's like, oh, he's obviously a deeply sexual man because he's wearing a neckerchief. But he's like, you're very talented and very pretty. And, like, just cups her face.
Yeah.
And I've just got written in, like, massive letters. Ew, gross.
Yeah, and he also was like looking at her drawing. She had like a sketchbook, and he was sort of.
That's when he's like, "You're very talented.
This is why, like,
and very pretty.
This is written by a man, and it's
look at my nipples under my neckerchief."
I'm actually really into a neckerchief personally, especially when one is topless and then, but also wearing a neckerchief.
Yeah.
And that was kind of 80s denim shorts. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a very sexual man.
He's obviously so sexual. Yeah. So then you get here to drink. Here you get some point of view shots of Alice. Like someone's watching her while she's fixing things or painting things.
Yeah. Isn't she like putting up, is it her that's putting up like the archery set?
No, this is the next scene. So in the next scene you get what I wrote, awkward flirting at the archery area.
Like, after almost killing.
Yeah. So you get this, I think it's Ned. Here we have Ned and a girl whose name I didn't catch until almost the end of the film. Because they never really like properly introduce them or give us any way to like track who's who. I get that Ned was I'm making quote fingers, the funny one, like the clown. But so you've got this woman, not Alice, not Annie, someone else.
And not Kevin Bacon.
And not Kevin Bacon. Jeez. I don't know, setting up the archery area, and then boom, like this arrow goes right past her face into the bullseye, and it's Ned. And so thus you have some very awkward flirting, including I believe what is a Humphrey Bogart impression. So
I was just kind of very confused.
Well, it was it's just bad writing. No one talks like this. The dialogue is just super stilted and awkward. So then you kind of, next scene, you get Annie, and she's running late. So she's finished her first part of the ride and she's now hitching a second ride. And apparently hitchhiking was just de rigueur in like the 80s, I guess. So I wrote, she wants to talk about her dreams.
She does like to talk about her dreams. She wants to work with kids, but she hates when people call them kids because they're not goats.
Right. They sound like little goats. Again, just strange dialogue.
And she's really, really chatty, and you can tell she's like super comfortable with whoever she's in the truck with. And as they're driving along and she's talking to this stranger about her hopes and dreams and baby goats, they drive past the entrance to Camp Crystal Lake, and she's like, hey, wait, wasn't that the turning? And they keep driving.
But don't you think, if I got in a car with someone and I was talking about, especially if I was talking about my dreams.
And goats.
And they just never replied or like opened their mouth. I mean, I would be super creeped out.
Yeah. No, she just is really, really happy to hear her own voice.
She's determined to fill that silence.
Yeah. And they drive past the entrance to Camp Crystal Lake. And she's like, oh, wait, haven't we missed our turn? And they keep going. And she's like, oh, I think we should pull over now. Which doesn't happen, of course. And she does kind of a clever thing. She literally like drops and rolls out of this moving car. She doesn't fuck around.
Yeah.
She's like straight away. She's like, okay, this isn't good. I'm out. And she jumps out of the moving car and she kind of lands pretty hard on the tarmac. And then she gets up and she's running into the woods. And she's being chased by someone in the woods.
And I did think one of the things that I think the film did well was to sort of you know, make you think that this point of view killer is male. So you can see sort of like flannel sleeves and you can see sort of trousers and boots. There's nothing really to give away that it's a female.
Fun fact, it was a man because, oh, what's her name who plays Mrs. Voorhees?
Betsy Palmer.
That's it, Betsy Palmer. When she arrived on set, she wasn't physically fit enough to do the running through the woods. So they, it was a guy who was doing it and they just kept the shots in because I think either they didn't care that it looked like a man or they liked that, it, like you said, it created that ambiguity about
yeah.
who the killer is. But yeah, it was actually a guy because the real killer was not fit enough to go running.
Which, I mean, it's fine. And I did sort of think, okay, like you just said, she's in the car and she's feeling as an Annie's in the car with this mute driver, but she's seemingly comfortable. So it would make sense. Like, oh, it's a female who's picked you up. So you're yeah. feeling non-threatened.
Exactly. You know, so, she's, as we see later on, she's like a nice older lady. You're not old, but you know, she's
yeah.
a middle-aged nice lady. It made me laugh a little bit when they said that she wasn't physically fit enough to be doing the running through the woods, which if you go to the fight scene at the end, that bitch is falling down all the time.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah, yeah. She definitely gets physical at the end there. Yeah,
yeah, but like she is not sturdy or sure on her feet at all.
But the killer sort of chases Annie. It's not, she doesn't really give too much of a chase, but
no.
Which again, like I sort of felt, and I thought this a few times throughout the film, if the plot had been ever so slightly more clever, like how interesting would it have been to have Annie, I don't know, escape, get away, maybe warn the other counselors, but they don't believe her, like add a little bit more tension. Because one of the things I think the film does not do very well is build tension.
Yeah,
it's seemingly really separate parts, and then nobody discovers each other's dead either, which, you know, that is a way to really ratchet up the fear and the tension, and they, and that it was just a missed opportunity, I feel. So
absolutely
they made some baffling choices in this film. But yeah, so anyway, so Annie's dead, like the person catches her and slits her throat.
And it was a very good throat cutting scene.
It was good. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Don't forget, like we hadn't seen stuff like effect for us now. It's like, yeah, it's a bit lame, but in 1980, it just hadn't been done.
Well, I mean, the thing is that you had violence in films. This was the other thing I was a little confused why the critics were so absolutely out of their minds. Like it's so violent. And it's like, well, you've had a Texas Chainsaw Massacre already. You know,
yes, but it's not. I don't think it was the violence, it was the gore. So if you think about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, we've talked about this a few times, where you, if you actually watch that film, you see very few people die. You see their bodies and you see the lead up to
their
it.
Bodies. Yeah.
But it's because they didn't have the technical abilities to make it look real enough. So it wasn't really done. Like even like in Halloween, gosh,
even gore. I mean, when did the thing? Oh, I guess that was like 81 or something, wasn't it? So maybe that was slightly later.
And
yeah,
the guy, I've forgotten his name, the guy who did the special effects on the thing, it was him, Tom Savini, and one other guy who were all around at the same time, and they were work together to develop all of these things, all of these different techniques of doing things. So yeah, they were all. We suddenly got a lot of it in the 80s because suddenly these techniques were being developed by these three special effects guys. And it's usually all like the really good ones, like The Thing and, you know, Friday the 13th and some of the ones later on, you know, American Werewolf in London, the transformation in that is incredible. But before the 80s and before these three guys really figured things out and sat down and did it, you just didn't see it happen. You'd see the run-up and the aftermath, but you wouldn't see the actual skin splitting on a throat whilst it's being cut, and you wouldn't see people die. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that when you listen to Tom Savini talk about it, he says it's because a lot of people have never actually seen somebody die. Tom Savini was in Vietnam, he was a combat photographer. So that's why he was so good at it, because he knew how people's bodies reacted when they died and what things really looked like. So that's right. why he was able to develop fake blood that actually looks like blood.
Yeah.
As opposed to like melted crayons and things like, you know, that you see in a lot of films.
Yeah.
And how he's like, when people die, their mouths slacken and they go all limp. Whereas if you look at a lot of people die, they're like, oh, my head's been cut off, and you know, they're still like looking quite pretty. So yeah, that's why I think it was a shock for some people around this time seeing these things, because they hadn't actually witnessed things like our girl Annie getting her throat slit.
Sure. And I mean, later when they show some of the other kill scenes, which are, in my opinion, more gory and more violent.
Yeah.
Yeah, like those later ones, I could definitely see how that would cause controversy. But this one, like the throat slitting, I'm like, well, we've seen this before. But
yeah.
But it was still a good one. It was still a good one. And I mean, he is very good at what he does. It's unfortunate he had to, you know, have such trauma
in order
to realistically convey it. But yeah.
We wouldn't have the films, you know, that we love so much, I don't think, if he hadn't gone through that. Now we get to the most important part of the film and the most important question, really. Caitlin, if you were a flavor of ice cream, what would you be?
I know. I again, the dialogue, I'm just giving two thumbs up here. I would be pralines and dick.
Ooh, yes.
That's my favorite flavor of ice cream.
Pralines and dick. Yeah.
Yep. And in fact, maybe that's where they got, maybe that's where Wayne's World stole that. Like random conversation about what flavor of ice cream would you be, Jenny?
Oh,
I'm getting mint chocolate chip, but I mean, I don't know.
I do like mint chocolate chip. I like all ice cream. I don't discriminate. I'm an ice cream slut.
So all flavors.
At the same time.
All flavors at the same time.
Every angle.
For a price.
I'll take Ben and Jerry at the same time.
There you go. Your flavor is Ben and Jerry. That's why they put this in the film, because it leads to this.
Yeah, like I said, it's the most important part of the film.
Oh, well, the counselors are swimming and having this profound conversation.
Yeah.
And then Ned, you know, the funny one, pretends to drown, which is, I mean, I don't know, sociopathic behavior at its finest. Like, he does that. I mean, fully fakes it to the point where, like, the rest of them are
They're all like two, like one of the guys, the kind of the least douchey of the white douche guys, dives in and is like swimming, and someone's like, one of the girls has got like a life preserver, and then someone else is like, oh, get the canoe, paddle out to him. So everybody's like rushing to get to him, and yeah, they get him and they swim him back to the dock and get him on the dock, and one of the guys is like, who knows CPR? And one of the girls is like, I do. So he's, you know, they're giving him CPR and mouth to mouth. And he tongue rapes her.
Yeah, it was not, it was not funny, or I don't know. But then again, you have this point of view shot of a person watching across the lake, like watching all of this happen. And you kind of see a ring on their finger. It looked to me like a big giant class ring. Quite masculine, but again, this could, so then they're sort of going back into their rooms, and Alice is in her, what do you call it, a camp, like your dorm room,
your cabin.
Yeah, where's Melissa when I need her? Melissa's my camp friend. I never went to camp when I was young. Personally, I always wanted to, but I never did, so I have no reference point for some of these things. But she's in her cabin and she sees a snake, and everybody just like loses their shit. And I'm sitting there thinking, you guys are at a camp. Have you never seen a snake before? Like, even I'm looking at that snake thinking, that's not a poisonous snake. It looks like probably like a grass snake or something. You could probably just
a long black, not to be thick, like a long black snake.
But the way they lose their minds, you'd think like there was an alien in there or something. I mean, they just go absolutely nuts. Eventually they kill it.
Which they killed for real.
No, did they?
Yeah. So this wasn't in the script. None of this scene was. And Tom Savini and one of the other guys were staying. They actually stayed on camp the whole time. And one night there was a snake in their cabin, and it's where they got the idea from. So they bring the snake in, and the snake handler's there on set with his snake. And yeah, they actually killed the snake. And apparently the snake handler cried. I would cry.
Why did the snake handler, or I guess he didn't know they were gonna do
but they did actually
clearly kill. They did not rehearse the scene, but
no,
I mean, but also the whole scene was just kind of like, what is the point of this adds nothing to the movie.
No,
you could trim the fat easily, and that
the only thing I think is that obviously when they chop its head off, it's kind of a hint as to what's coming to the end of the film, I guess. But
I guess, but being that the film goes in no way to give any other sort of like hint as to what's to come or anything like that, it's to me, it's just strange.
I know.
But anyway, so then you have what I consider to be the best character in the whole film. A policeman rocks up on his motorcycle while the
fun. I've just remembered some of the dialogue from the cop, and I'm just laughing. God,
he's amazing. It's like he took all of his inner monologue from Reefer Madness, and that's like where he's like so angry. Yeah.
He's like, hey, like Colombian gold, weed, hash, you get it?
He says, Colombian gold, grass, hash, the weed. He calls it the weed.
The weed.
But anyway, so the cop pulls up on them to give them, I guess, some sort of warning. Like, he's in the area, and he's looking for Crazy Ralph, I think.
Yeah, so they're looking for Crazy Ralph.
Crazy Ralph's missing, and he proceeds to call Crazy Ralph the following things. The town crazy, the loony, and then he refers to the guy with Ned, the funny one, is when the police rocks up, he's wearing, like, an Indian headdress. And calls him Tonto. So he's simultaneously like, I don't know, sort of anti-mental health, anti-Native American Indian. Like, he's just incredible. In literally the shortest space of time, he establishes himself as quite literally the best character in the whole film.
Yeah, so I've just written down the most amazing dialogue of the film.
I said he gets all the best lines. Yep. Definitely. So anyway, then the cop leaves, sadly, and then you get Alice, and she's in the kitchen, and she opens the pantry door, and there's Crazy Ralph, and who genuinely I think scares the shit out of her, and he sort of starts to warn her like ominously about
this place, you know, is cursed. And doesn't he say like God sent him?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And it's like, well, can God send you somewhere else? Like, this isn't Jesus camp anymore.
But I'll be honest, I said to Jenny at the top of the show, there were a couple moments in this film where I spaced out. I wasn't doing anything. I'm sitting there watching it, but my mind just kind of wandered because I was not hyper engaged with the film. And I don't think it has anything to do with, like, some horror films age better than others. So of course there is that. And I, you know, you always give a credit like film where it's due. But yeah, so I spaced out a little bit here. I don't know quite what happened. And I came back and wrote Kevin Bacon and Marcy.
I've kind of done the same, I think, because it's gone from God sent me to, oh, Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon acting his ass off here with this shitty dialogue. So
yeah, it's like his first or second film, I think.
And the hair is on point. But he's talking to Marcy. And again, you get this kind of point of view shot of the killer, you know, giving you the feeling that they're being watched. And then it sort of pans out and you see that actually Ned is watching them. So Ned is kind of, he has this moment on his own where he's sort of whistling and walking. And he sees what looks like a figure go into a neighboring cabin. And so he decides to follow them and see who it is. So he's missing. And then you've got this sort of dialogue between Kevin Bacon and Marcy, and she talks about her dreams.
He has zero interest in her weird blood dreams.
Yeah. And oh yes, not dreams like Annie's dreams, like hopes and dreams. This is actually like nighttime dreaming dreams. And as we all know, there's nothing more boring to hear than someone else's dreams. And so Kevin Bacon is doing his absolute best to pretend like he's intrigued.
Because he wants to get laid.
And also, he's giving it all with the acting. He's like, this could be my big break.
Yep.
Little does he know, next he's going to do Footloose. So he wasn't wrong. But yeah, so he's, I don't know. Who wrote this? Because who the fuck cares? All of this could be trimmed out. It goes no way into giving any sort of character development that we care about. So
nope.
Then a storm comes. There's a big storm coming and they run away to bang, basically.
Yeah, despite the fact that in her dream she's talking about like there's a storm and it's raining and it's all this, and suddenly the rain turns to blood. Apparently she loves being fucked in the storm because she is well into it.
She is into it, yeah. You get this not very sexy sex scene.
No.
Although I did write, I love her 70s flared trousers, which is, I did. And yeah, they run away basically to bang. And then you have really, I guess you'd say, I'd almost say it's not a split screen, but you have like two scenes happening simultaneously. So you've got Kevin Bacon and Marcy on the one hand who are having sexy time. And then on the other hand, you've got the girl whose name I still don't know, Alice and Phil. I think he's called Phil.
Maybe. But we have just seen them. This is the bit I didn't understand. So obviously Kevin Bacon and is it Marcy he's with?
Yeah, that's yeah. his girlfriend, I think.
Yeah, so they're having sex on the bottom bunk. And as it kind of pulls, like the camera pulls away after they've kind of finished and they're snuggling, or while they're still having sex even, you see Ned is dead on the bunk above them.
Yeah, with his throat slit.
Yeah. So we don't see him die. Once he disappears into that cabin following that figure, we don't see anything else. But somehow he's now dead on the bunk above them and they haven't noticed.
They're too busy. They're too busy getting it on.
Yep.
So, yeah. So you've got the sexy time scene with the dead body on the top bunk sort of happening at the same time as the other three are in kind of a common area. And
yeah, I think it's like the big, like the dining room or something, the dining hall. And this scene I actually think is even sexier than the actual sex scene, because they're playing that classic game, Strip Monopoly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've all played it.
We've all played Strip Monopoly, right?
Yeah, so that's happening. But yeah, so you kind of go back and forth between the scenes, and they're, you know, giving up clothes instead of paying rent, I think is how the game works. But yeah, so as you flash back over to Kevin Bacon and Marcy, she kisses him and says she's going to be finished banging. And so she's going to go take a shower. So she gives him a kiss, she takes her little raincoat. And this is where I sort of realized the bathroom is like an outhouse. So anytime any of them go to the bathroom, they have to bring all their stuff to shower. It's like dorm room showers, basically. Well,
it's like camping. You know, you go to a campsite, if you're camping, you go to the shower block. That's where the toilets and the showers and things are. Like, you have to walk to it with all your stuff.
But I definitely, when I thought of it more as an outhouse, I thought it was creepier. Because again, it's like dark and it's raining. And so she's got her yellow, like little rain jacket, and she kisses Kevin Bacon and goes off to shower. And while he's lying there getting high, of all things, he's stabbed through the bed, like through the underneath of the bed with an arrow. It's an arrow, right? Like an archery arrow.
Brilliant. This is probably my favorite death scene in this film. And yeah, I love it. Yeah, he's lying on the bed and something drips on his face and he touches it and he realizes it's blood and the blood's seeping through from Ned above. But before he has time to react, this like arrow comes through his throat and out. And when they did this, so Kevin Bacon was sat like upright. So you've just got his head coming out of the pillow.
Yeah.
And then it's a fake neck and torso, like lying down. So Kevin Bacon's like sat upright and then the rest of it's lying down. It's his real arms. And then Tom Savini was underneath the bed with an arrow and a bag full of blood. And when he poked it through, the blood was supposed to spurt out, but it didn't. So when they do it and it goes through this, like, I think this is like this other, like this kid that was helping Tom Savini just had to blow with a straw to get all the blood spurting out, which is why you get that like really kind of realistic, like gurgly blood sound.
Yeah.
Because it is from someone like blowing. So it actually worked out better. But yeah, Kevin apparently took them 3 hours to get him into this, this contraption.
You can tell, like, in my opinion, you can tell that the head is but the effects are still good. I mean, that's not my favorite kill, but it is a good
one. Okay. I like it.
So then you kind of go back over to Monopoly time, and it's like they're in various states of undress, and the door kind of like flies open, and they're like, oh my god, who is it? Well, it's no one. But then homegirl, I kept calling her the archery girl. I don't know what the fuck her name is, but she's like, oh, I've left my windows open. I've got to go.
Well, before that, because obviously Marcy is in the toilets. She went to the shower room, to the outhouse after.
Oh, does Marcy die before?
Yes, it's Marcy first. Okay. Yeah. So
did you note that she was doing impressions in the bathroom?
Yeah, I didn't really understand what was happening. So she goes into the bathroom and she's like, passing around, and then she hears a noise and she's like, oh, Kevin Bacon, because I don't remember his name.
Jack,
that's it. I'm like, why would he have followed her to the toilets? And then she forgets that, like, she thinks that there's somebody in there with her and starts doing weird impressions in the toilet, in the mirror. It's like, is she okay? Like, no, because she gets an axe to the face.
She does get an axe to the face. Yeah, that was a good one.
And now we go back. Yeah, this is when we go back to the Monopoly scene. And the archery girl is the most undressed. Alice still has her clothes on. The guy is kind of shirtless.
He's topless.
Yeah, he's topless. Yeah, and Marcy's like, oh, yeah, like I said, the door blows open. She's, and you know, we're like, what, an hour into the storm? And she's like, oh, I forgot my windows are open. I best go in, put my rain jacket on over my underwear.
And run out into the night.
So I've got written down, now she will be punished for being too eager to take her clothes off.
100%. And then you sort of have this, seemingly, in my opinion, out of nowhere. Because if you're tying the threads of a movie together, I think you just can't, like, completely forget about one for, I don't know, a solid, I don't know, 60, 70 minutes. So then all of a sudden you've got Steve the boss in the diner. Doing some awkward flirting with the waitress.
Yes, it's very, very awkward. Very awkward.
She's clearly trying to bang him.
Yeah, and she's like, I don't know, like a bit older.
60, probably.
Yeah, she's like an older lady, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just very, very awkward.
She's into his neckerchief, clearly.
Yes, she is into neckerchief. And it's hammering it down outside, and she's basically telling him not to drive back to the camp to stay with her, I'm guessing. And he's like, I need to go back. I have 6 new counselors. And I'm like, not anymore, you don't. You've probably only got a good 3 left at this point. Yeah, and then we go back to the outhouse. Yeah, Marcy's now, she's gone back to her cabin, I think, closed the windows, got her stuff. She goes
Not Marcy, the archery
girl. Oh, not Marcy, girl. Sorry, the archery girl.
I have heard that she might be called Brenda. She might be.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Who knows? No one cares. I don't even think Brenda cared. If that's her name. But yeah, so she after closing her windows and getting into her like cute little nightdress and getting into her raincoat, she goes back to the outhouse. It's just really creepy in there. And it reminded me why I hate whenever I'm camping, if I need to pee in the middle of the night and you get up and you have to walk all the way to the shower block. And it's like, this is really creepy. I don't like it. So she's in there and she's just kind of like, I don't know. She keeps hearing noises, but doesn't see anyone. They all seem to like just not worry about the fact that, I mean, Marcy got hit in the face with an axe and there is no significant blood anywhere, but it's like there's probably some on the floor and she's like, oh, I'm imagining she's just like, oh, someone's got their period or something. I don't really know. It's like,
can't blood,
there can't be no blood,
right? I have here, and I think I missed some parts too, because I frankly got a little like bored. I mean, yeah,
I
don't
was
know
bored how, at this point.
Yes, because I have here that she runs out in the rain and there's like a car with headlights.
So, not quite, not yet. So she has...
I spaced out again.
Yeah, she gets creeped out and then she goes back to her cabin, I think. And then we go back to the boss, Steve. And he's getting a ride back to the camp with the cop.
Oh, yeah, because his car broke down.
His car broke down. He's driving his car broke down. So then the police officer's like, oh, I'll take you. And they are driving back. And then we keep kind of jumping back and forth a little bit at this point. So then we go back to Archery Girl. And, yeah, she's in her cabin. And it's like the least relaxing looking place ever. There's all these like windows. It's a storm. Like there's no power. She's got this like little candle around. And just as she's like settling into sleep, you just hear this, help me.
That was really good.
Thank you. And I like the fact that at first she's like, yeah, fuck this. This is probably like funny guy Ned pulling a prank on me or something. So she just gets into bed. And she's lying there. And you hear it again. It's like, help me. Like a little kid voice. And eventually she does come out. And she's just in her nightie in the rain. Like, I don't think she's got a raincoat on at this point. I can't remember. Because I've got written down, I would not be running around in the rain in my nightie. And
no, she was in her nightie for sure, yeah.
She kind of gets attacked. Oh, her name's Linda, I think.
I thought it was Brenda.
Okay, I've just got a note that says, Linda, where is she? She must be with Jack and Marcy. So Jack and Marcy's Kevin Bacon and Marcy. So Linda, yeah.
Well, there is. So I think we both sort of lost it a little bit here. And I think it's not our fault because the movie is just not that compelling at this particular moment. And this is also where you know, in Antlers, for example, we were talking about pacing, like how far rhythm and pacing goes in a film in terms of not just keeping your attention and keeping you engaged, but in building that sense of like tension. And so you and I are both like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm spaced out. You're probably like, I think at one point I even wrote like, went to get snacks, like I don't know. But so you've got Alice and Phil, and they go looking for Brenda after hearing screams, and they assume that she's with Kevin Bacon and Marcy.
Yeah, and I'm like, what? So they've all disappeared for an orgy?
Well, yeah, then they also can't find Nettie, and I'm thinking, yeah, guys, it's been like hours, and just now you're figuring out you can't find anybody.
And so also, they're saying they can't find them. And I mean, I guess it's because, you know, the killer has moved the bodies, because later on you kind of discover them all. Obviously, earlier on when Jack and Marcy were fucking, Ned's on the top bunk. So what has, in this like period of time, has she managed to kill Marcy and kill Jack and then somehow clean up all of the mess in their bedrooms? Isn't their bedroom not the first place you'd go and look, like their cabin? There's no way that those cabins are spotless and not blood-free. But anyway, yeah, she's with Phil, did you say his name was?
I think it's Phil, but yeah, they decide that they can't find anyone, so they're going to go call somebody. So they
Even before that, they find a bloody axe in the bed.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, what's this? What's going on?
Okay.
And then they go into the bathroom, and then it's only at this point one of them says, I think it's the girl. I think it's, what's her name? Alice. I really think we should call someone. And I quite like this part.
They go
to like Steve's office and it's locked. And she doesn't hesitate. She smashes the window to get in there, to get to the phone. The phones are dead. And then I think the guy, like Phil says, well, don't worry, you know, we'll be laughing about this in the morning. I don't think you'll be laughing.
There will be no morning.
There will be, exactly.
So then where you're with the cop in the car.
Yeah, we go back to to Steve and the cop in the car. And it's like, this bit I quite like, because it's like, oh, they're literally like right down the road. And it's like, yes, they're there. Someone's going to save them. And the cop gets a radio that he has to go. There's been like a car crash and he has to go. So Steve has to get out and walk. And he's just like walking along and he gets to the Camp Crystal Lake sign and there's a torch in his face. And he looks up and he sees someone. And it's like, oh, hi, what are you doing here? Because he obviously recognizes whoever it is. And obviously what that person was doing there is stabbing him, because he gets stabbed to death.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you've got Alice and Phil. And I wrote, she loses Phil. I feel like lights go or something.
Yeah, the lights go. So he's like, oh,
checking the generator.
Yeah, he's going to go out to the generator. So she just curls up and goes to sleep.
As you do.
Yeah. Bloody axe in the bed. Everyone missing. Power's out. Phones are dead. I'm just going to have a nap.
I feel so relaxed.
Yeah, I'm totally relaxed right now.
So Alice, yeah, so she loses Phil. She goes looking for him and she finds
Is his name Bill?
Phil.
Sorry, I've got a note that says Bill. It wasn't Bill. And I'm like, who's Bill?
You're like, Linda, Bill, who are these people?
Like,
Brenda and Phil, I swear to God. Where's Annie? That's all I know. she goes looking for Bill, Phil, I'm not sure, but she goes looking for him, finds him nailed to the back of the door with his throat slit. And that was one that I really enjoyed, like just the effects of him nailed to the door. Like, I loved that. Well, he's axed through the door, really.
Yeah.
So then Alice goes full MacGyver and she starts rigging, I don't know, a rope to like a log. And then she's got like a credenza and like a desk and a bunch of chairs. She's just in a full panic, and so she's kind of run back to the communal area and she is just throwing everything in front of the door. It's the rope around the log that really does it for me, because I don't really know what that's meant to do.
No,
but yeah,
she gets that rope.
It's just like whatever's lying around, like,
yeah,
I'm gonna take this pen, this notebook, like just anything she can get, shoves it in front of the door. And then
she's just hiding out with
she's just.
But I love the fact she's like, right, I'm going to tie this door shut and I'm going to secure the windows by closing the curtains. they can't see me. I'm not here.
I'm not here. I'm closing my eyes. Exactly. And the thing is, I had so much hope for Alice because she seems like this smart one. Maybe because she had the Princess Di haircut.
Yeah,
she
smashes the window to get to the phone.
Yeah.
And to be fair, at this point, she is looking for a weapon and she has like a baseball bat, and then she finds like a long spiky fork thing.
Yes.
And she finally thinks, okay, she's getting her wits together. She's like making a plan. And then her friend's corpse is thrown through the window.
This is where I wrote eating snacks. So I left to eat some snacks. I mean, the movie was still playing, but I was eating snacks. Yeah. So I'm not really sure what happened.
Snacks are more important. But yeah, so
I wasn't at all like stoned during this movie. Not at all. I just needed
some snacks. This is why I had the snacks with me.
Yeah, you were smart. You were smart.
I was smart.
I just, after eating snacks, I wrote, eventually she runs into Mrs. Voorhees.
Yeah. So she's freaking out because her friend's been thrown through the window and she had no snacks. So she like runs out into the night, and yeah, you see this like truck, you see the Jeep basically. Mm. And at this point, I mean, obviously we all know it's Mrs. Voorhees because it's an old film and it's a very, you know, it's very alert. Important in horror cinema and culture and whatever. But if this is your first time watching it and you knew nothing about this film, this would actually be your first hint as to who the killer is, because this is when we see the truck that we saw Annie in, yep, earlier in the film.
Right. The Jeep, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, she runs out and she's like, runs into this woman. She's like, and the woman's like weirdly calm. It's like, oh hi, I'm Mrs. Voorhees. I'm, you know, a friend.
I'm friends with the Christies.
Yeah, like with Steve, and like, yeah, everything's okay. And poor, yes, Alice is like, friends are dead and thing. And Mrs. Voorhees is like, oh, I'm sure it's fine. Let's go look at all your dead friends.
She's like, she is so calm, and she gives, yeah, really like this monologue. I mean, it is just, you can tell this is her moment to shine. This is her Academy Award-winning monologue. She really takes her time here.
Yeah.
With everything. You know, she
only, Betsy Palmer only did this film because she needed a new car.
I did read that, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and Betsy Palmer, just to throw a little info here about Betsy Palmer, Betsy Palmer's kind of a legend. Like, she's comes from a strong, like, theater background. She did tons of Broadway. She graduated from DePaul. It wasn't called DePaul then. It was called something else. But if you think, like, that's where John C. Reilly graduated and, like, Gillian Anderson. And so, anyway, she goes on to be the, I think she's like the host of a game show in the 70s that was super popular in America. I never watched it, but she was super well known for that. And then she did lots of TV. She was just kind of in everything. And I know that she was the understudy for some very famous women, like on Broadway. So I think she was always kind of on that cusp of super famousness and didn't quite reach it, because I don't think she's a bad actress. I mean, she does really well with what she's given, you know, in terms of script in this. Yeah. But
yeah, you have the bit where, like, yeah, like Alice is showing her, I think, in the outhouse when she's found, and like her friend, one of them's dead, and she's like, oh my lord, so young, so pretty.
So young, yeah.
What kind of monster could do that? It's like, you bitch.
Alice runs into the forest to get away from her after.
Well, yeah, because she still hasn't realized, but yeah, and you have this whole thing where Mrs. Voorhees is like, did you know a young boy drowned here a year before those counselors were killed? And she's like, you know, his name was Jason. Jason should have been watched at all times.
They were making love.
Yeah, and she's like, they were making love. They weren't watching him. And then she starts talking like to herself, like, I'm helping. Or you hear like a thing, you're like, help me. In her head, or I don't really know. It's like, help me, mummy. She's like, I am helping you, Jason. Yeah, mummy is killing them all for you.
She starts talking to herself.
Yeah.
As Jason, and it's very creepy and disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, look and what you did to him. Yeah. And at this point, yeah, like Alice is like, fuck this. She hits Mrs. Voorhees and runs to the car. And this is where my kind of faith in Alice gets lost, because she runs to the car and finds the car. And Annie is dead in the car. She doesn't know, never even met Annie. Annie never made it to camp, bless her, but you know, still there's a dead body in the car. So she just goes and, like, instead of running to the road or running, you know, pushing the body out the car and driving the still running Jeep or doing anything, like, she just kind of stays around the camp, really. Yeah. And you have like, yeah, Mrs. Voorhees kind of coming after her, going, kill her, mommy. Don't let her get away. Don't let her live. And they have this amazing tussle, which results in a full-on clam slam.
It does. Yeah.
It does. And she gets away, and she's kind of hiding near this little boat. And you see Mrs. Voorhees, like, go after her. And, like, honestly, I don't know how she... Oh, the element of surprise must have been the only way she managed to kill all these other people, because she, like, she gets knocked down. She every
goes,
time
she goes down pretty easy. Yeah,
yeah.
But then you, so they have this, like, she collapses and Alice, well, she runs and she runs into the kitchen, Alice, and she hides in the pantry. And I thought this part was one of the only parts really that you kind of felt some suspense. I mean, I don't know about you, but I liked how, like, the you could hear her, like, rummaging, and Alice is, like, in the pantry. Like, the camera the whole time is on Alice in the pantry, just kind of, like, trying to be still, like, locking the door, making sure, like, trying to catch her breath, trying to, like, relax for just a second. And then the lights flip on in the background, and you can hear Mrs. Voorhees, like, rummaging around, and obviously, eventually, she smashes in the pantry. And Alice has grabs like a pan, like a frying pan, and fucking smacks the shit out of her on the head. And I'm thinking, like, come on, Alice, don't you know? You got a kill shot to the head. Kill shot to the head.
This keeps happening. She keeps knocking
this
her down.
This is like the third time. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, she's got a nosebleed. She must be dead. Oh, there's a spot of blood. She must be dead. No. So, yeah, she goes down to the dock. Again, why is she going down to the dock? Why not to the Jeep or the car, you know, to the road, whatever. But she's down the dock and she's looking in the water like, ah, finally. And then you see Mrs. Voorhees appear in the reflection and grabs her. And now they're just like rolling around. I even wrote down like she's gonna hug her to death. Like what does she think she's gonna do?
They're wrestling. They're literally wrestling. Yeah. And the music here, it's worth noting, it's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah. So that
really is.
Alice eventually machetes Mrs. Voorhees' head off. In slow motion, no less.
In slow motion. And I've got written down, you've been Tom Savini'd.
So then finally, Alice, finally. Now she's learned. It's all about the head. The head's gotta come off. Yep. So then you have this kind of like serene music starts playing. And you're like,
She gets into the boat and paddles onto the lake. It's not really sure why.
Sail as the
let's,
sun comes.
Yeah, let's go on the lake. Why, you know, I've just killed the killer. Why not just
she's exhausted, walk? Jenny. She's tired.
Yeah, she I guess she's in shock. So she gets into the boat and paddles onto the lake.
It's very tranquil.
Yeah, we have beautiful music.
And the police kind of arrive. She made it.
Yeah, the police arrive. You see the police looking out at the lake.
Everything's okay.
Call out to her and she wakes up. All is okay. Nope.
So you've got Jason's burned, mutilated, rotting flesh body rises out of the water and grabs her. And this, again, talk about like blatant, you know, just being very referential, stealing from everyone. Like, this is straight out of Carrie.
It
and
is.
Carrie happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This, like, again, wasn't in the script. This was Tom Savini said he just saw Carrie and was like, the ending was just a bit like of the film. It was just a bit blah. And he was like, well, what if we do our own version of the Carrie ending with the hand, because it's such a good scare.
I mean, yeah, and it was good. I mean, it is like first, like, so Carrie was, I think, 1976. So yeah. I mean, okay, but and it is good, like it is, but it's just so blatantly stolen from everything. But yeah. And then all of a sudden Alice wakes up and she's in the hospital and you're kind of thinking, oh, it was a nightmare. So I did. Again, very Carrie, but yeah. And then she asks about Jason, and the doctor's like, oh no, like, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah, because she's like, oh, are they, so is it the police in there? And she's like, oh, is everybody dead? And she's like, yes, ma'am. He's like, oh, did you find the boy? And he's like, what boy? And she's like, the one who tried to kill me, and they all look confused. And then you have this kind of very dazed look on her face, where she's like, that means he's still there.
He's still there. And then end. Le fond. End scene. So there you have it. Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th.
Does it take place in the 80s? Check.
Yep.
Is it a summer movie? Check. Is it a slasher film? Check.
Is it full of a cast whose names you can't remember and don't really care about?
Check.
I have checked. We were both right. She was called Brenda, not Linda, but I was right. It was Bill, not Phil. So that's one each to us.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I mean, and you know what I just thought of? When does, like, the hockey mask come into play?
Film 3.
Film three. Okay, yeah. Because like he's so known for that, and actually,
yeah, yeah. And the machete, none of it comes into the third film. Mm. So in the second film, it starts with in the second film, he's kind of still quite scrawny and quite small. He's an adult, but he's quite small, and he has like a sack on his head because he's supposed to be like quite deformed as when he was alive. I think he was like a special needs kid, and that's because like Mrs. Voorhees worked in the kitchen, so her son was obviously there and no one was watching him, and that's why she said he's supposed to be supervised. So he was already supposed to be quite disfigured before spending 20 years living in the woods and in the lake or whatever it is he's supposed to have been doing. But yeah, so the hockey mask doesn't come in until the third one. Someone is wearing it and pulls a prank, and he basically kills that person and steals the hockey mask.
Right. Well,
I mean, you can't, that's the thing, like we'd think with Friday the 13th it'd be how many hockey masks, how many machetes, but no, it's none of that. How many raincoats?
How many neckerchiefs? I was just thinking that. Get out of my brain, Jenny.
How many neckerchiefs do you give this film, Caitlin?
I feel like it's a tough one. I don't know about you, because I feel like there is such a guilty pleasure element to it, and there is, I'm highly entertained. I may not be scared, and I may not be fully paying attention the whole time, because sometimes you need snacks or sometimes you space out. So I would probably give it 3 neckerchiefs.
Do you know what? I agree. 3.
Yeah, and I feel like it's a little low, but this is also just my personal thing. Like, I watch scary movies to be scared, and yes, there are guilty pleasures, and you and I have talked about this even a little bit with like Drag Me to Hell, where you get sort of that black comedy element, and it can be fully enjoyable and absolutely like a pleasurable experience and not necessarily be afraid. But personally, for me, it's not scary, and there are so many easy fixes in this film, like ways that they could have made it better that seem, and maybe it's that sort of hindsight is 2020, but it's like, you know, there are choices that the director could have made. There are script edits that could have happened. There are ways.
Any script edits.
Bring a woman in and see how women actually talk, because it's pretty much like none of the dialogue that you've written. Sorry, Sean. You know, and then, but then I have to give it sort of credit where it's due, in the sense that, okay, listen, you blatantly ripped off 3 of like the biggest horror films that there are. I'm talking about Black Christmas, Halloween, Carrie.
Yeah.
And we're mildly successful at it. So I don't know. What about you?
I think this film definitely took some of the things that we take for granted in slashers now. Things like, you know, the whole you have sex, you die, that kind of thing, all stems from this film. They took it and purposely ran with it. Because you think about it, like we've talked about this when we did the Halloween. It was kind of accidental. They never meant for that to be kind of what happened. It just was what some people read from it. They never intended there to be like these rules, and all the rules that we joke about, you know, in Scream, for example, that kind of thing. Like, a lot of it stems from Friday the 13th and this franchise. And I think the idea of a long running franchise kind of came from this, because yes, Halloween, and then we had Halloween 2 and then Halloween 3. And obviously there have been many, many, many sequels since then. But like I said, like between 1980 and 1989, they churned out 8 of these films. That's a lot.
I mean, the franchise in and of itself is very successful. I don't know that anyone's ever going to talk about the Friday the 13th film franchise in terms that are anything more than like fondness yes, there is an appreciation for Tom Savini's skill here, you know, for sure. Like we say, we like to give credit where it's due, but I think overwhelmingly, like, this is not a franchise that I personally will return to. You know, like when you say you want to cover them all,
I'm joking, I don't want to.
I will do it, but I might cry. There have to be a lot of snacks. I think
we should put it out to a vote. We should let the listeners, and they can pick which of the Friday the 13th franchise movies they want us to watch.
Because even like, think about it, even like Freddy versus Jason, some of what I love so much about that film is that it's pure camp and it's silly.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And there is a part of me that really loves horror films that give you like that camp kind of feeling as well. That's fine. There is a place for that, 100%. I don't know. I'm just not one of those people that loves every single horror film that comes out. There are some people who do.
Oh, yeah.
They have no discernment whatsoever, and they love it all. And you know what? Fair play to them. But For me, yeah, I don't know. And I think this is the issue with slashers overwhelmingly anyway, is that you tend to not care so much about the characters. You really get much more into inventive kills. Yeah. And that can be entertaining, but I like to care about the characters that I'm watching. Exactly. And I like to care about what happens to them. So
I care about Laurie Strode. I do not care about Alice.
Yeah. And isn't that funny how even with Halloween, but they chose of Halloween, I think, to intentionally focus more on one character. I didn't so much care about the other girls. I did a little bit more than I did on Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
But I didn't care about them the way I cared about Laurie Strode. And the same is true with even Black Christmas. You know, you've got the lead, Olivia Hussey. I can't remember her name.
I can't remember her name either.
But, you know, who is your sort of protagonist. And you care. You care about her and what happens to her. Not so much the others, but. And as far as like the feminist aspect goes, I feel like it was kind of like a free-for-all. Like, I don't think that Alice necessarily survived because she was a virgin, because it was hinted at that she wasn't a virgin. So, yeah, I don't know. What was your take on that part of it?
There were good parts to Alice's character. Like I said, you know, she seemed to have a bit more depth than some of the other characters, you know, a bit more development. Mm. We were given that kind of weird glimpse into some sort of, you know, backstory with Steve, and the fact that she likes to draw and she's an artist, and you know, she's unsettled, and then she's quite, you know, quite strong-minded and things, that she is less enthusiastic about taking her clothes off. Like, she's the only one, and she's like umming and ahhing about still doing it while they're playing. She has no hesitation in smashing the window to get in to get to the phone, but then she does really stupid things like takes a nap and doesn't seem particularly freaked out that someone's put a bloody axe in the bed and that kind of thing.
Just like poor character development on the part of the writer. Like,
so I'm not even sure if it's
that aren't in line with what she's established her character to be. Like, I completely agree. And she did exhibit a lot of elements of, like, let's say independence, or, you know, just kind of like thinking for herself, or like being proactive about things.
But yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a solid 3. I think I actually enjoy the second one more than this from memory. I think the second one is a more interesting film and has more interesting characters. Won't be rushing to watch it again. Glad we did it, because it is the kind of original summer camp. Like, we couldn't do like summer camp slashers without doing this one first.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like the, as we said at the top of the show, it's like the daddy of the 80s summer slasher movies. Yeah. Like,
exactly.
And the trashier, you know, uncle, like Eddie of,
The Uncle Eddie
of the genre. I mean, definitely. And this is the thing, like, I haven't seen it. I think I said 2017, 2018. So it was about time to check back in on this movie. And then I'll leave it for another 5-6 years. And maybe, you know, I would consider watching the remake. It'd be interesting to see, like, do they improve on it, on the formula, or do they just,
I haven't seen formula? It. I know. I was listening to something where they were talking about it, and they're talking about the fact that, you know, at one point, apparently, I think in the flashback where they're showing, this is either in the remake or in one of the later films, I'm not sure, but there's like a scene where they're showing like when Jason drowns when he's a kid, and like all the counselors are like full on like fucking on the steps of the cabin, like outside, and they're just not paying attention, as opposed to, like, you know.
Wow. Right.
Yeah. So I think it gets a bit more extreme as it gets more modern, but yeah.
Well, and that is, like you said earlier, partially due to our tolerance level for kind of violence and gore is higher than it has ever been, probably. I mean, in terms of audience. And so to elicit that kind of shocking response, you have to do more. So this is why I think I really get into films that are clever, and where you really care about the characters, and the gore and the inventive kills aren't so necessary to shocking your audience or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, 3s all around, and I'm glad we did it. I don't think you can have a horror movie podcast without talking about Friday the 13th. So there you have it.
Yeah. And I'm very much looking forward to watching and talking about more films like this in our summer slasher 80s-ish bonanza.
Bonanza. I just love that word. But
yeah, it's a great word.
Well, anyway, thanks for joining us, guys, as always. You know, talk to us, share things, give us reviews, rate, review, subscribe, like, share. We love you. And until next time,
Brothers Keg, take us out.
Bye.
Bye.